Today's presenting sponsor is SimpliSafe Home Security. When it comes to home security, traditional reactive measures after a break-in has already begun. Just don't cut it. SimpliSafe is the leading proactive security system designed to prevent the disaster entirely. I'm sitting with someone who has set up a SimpliSafe system all by himself. How was it? How'd it go?
A dream. Easy. And I, you know, not like I'm a carpenter, you know, not Bob Vila over here. Remember him?
Yeah.
You know, it's not this old house where I'm living. It is an old house, but it's not this old house. You know what I'm saying?
Yep, I do.
And I set up SimpliSafe. Easy to do. Customize it. Great. Customer support. Great. App. Great. Recommend it.
Boom. With SimpliSafe, you can customize your system to fit your needs. It's more than just a security camera. It's a comprehensive system of sensors, indoor and outdoor cameras, and 24/7 professional monitoring. The app-guided setup is simple, and there's no drilling required, so you can just install and arm your system in under an hour. There are no long-term contracts or cancellation fees. Monitoring plans start at around $1 a day. Don't miss out on the extended 4th of July deal just for our listeners. Right now, you can get a massive 70% off your new system at simplysafe.com/crooked. That's an incredible 70% off your home security at simplysafe.com/crooked. Hurry, because there's no safe like SimpliSafe.
Welcome to PodSafe America. I'm Dan Pfeiffer.
And I'm Alex Wagner.
John is off this week. On today's show, Graham Plantner suspends his campaign against Susan Collins, and now there's a very crowded, very chaotic race to succeed him. The war in Iran appears to be starting back up again, even though Donald Trump is confused about the name of the country he's attacking. That's a real thing. Then former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper talks to me about the campaign for Senate. Alex, thanks for being here today and replacing John.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Although, I mean, we all miss John whenever he's away. Crazy shit happens, Stan.
It's true. He spends his vacations in the middle of online fiascos. That's neither here nor there. Okay. Let's start with the Plantner news. 2 long days after Politico broke the story that Plantner had allegedly raped a former girlfriend, Plantner posted an 11-minute video on Wednesday evening saying he would file the formal paperwork to withdraw his name from the ballot, but also sharing a lot of other thoughts, too. Let's take a listen.
I think as many of you know, over the past couple days, I have faced some very serious allegations, and I just want to make it clear, this is all false. I think it's really important to understand why this is happening in the timeline, why this is happening right now. I only have until July 13th until I am officially the nominee. This was the last week to try to get me off of the ballot. And that's why this is occurring. It's not the false allegations, though, that have brought us to where we are. It's the fact that they are being used by the political establishment to put structural pressure on us. What comes next needs to come from the people. I'm not trying to dictate to anyone who it should be or how we get there, but I will say this. It needs to be open, transparent, and democratic.
As of this recording on Thursday afternoon, Plantner has not actually filed the paperwork to have his name removed. The deadline is 5 p.m. Eastern time on Monday, but there is reporting that he will wait until then to do it. Alex, what are your thoughts on his decision to drop out and the message in that video?
Asshole, asshole, asshole. Those are my thoughts. First of all, nobody needed to hear Graham Plantner uncensored for 12 minutes. And the conceit in that video is preposterous. That I guess we're meant to believe that a rape victim is a crisis actor, and that crisis acting is being used by the Democratic establishment to get Graham Plantner out of the race. Never minding that Plantner's exit from the race greatly complicates the race and potentially throws it further into jeopardy. And there's no mention. We thankfully did not play the whole video, but he never mentions any of the women who came forward on the record talking about violence and aggression, if not outright assault and rape. He never mentions and pushes back on any of those things. He just says this is all part of a deep state plot. I mean, it's totally outrageous, but maybe the most egregious part of it, I think, is the fact that he suggests that the system is hopelessly flawed and corrupted, and that machine politics would not abide an insurgent grassroots campaign. The mission of the establishment right now is to quash real reform and real accountability, which is, you can have jaded views about the establishment, and I'm sure there's every reason for Graham Plattner to have some of those and for some of his supporters too. But right now, if the goal really is to oust Susan Collins, Graham Plattner needs to make people believe, he does not need to further disillusion his supporters. He does not need to spin paranoid conspiracy theories. He does not need anybody in Democratic politics in Maine to feel like this system is entirely rigged against them. He needs people to believe that there can be a good outcome. He needs to put whatever momentum he has left into the next candidate, and he's done exactly the opposite. I mean, I just think it's completely unconscionable that this is the way this guy is exiting the race.
My take on this is the subject line of your excellent newsletter, Substack newsletter, How the Hell, which is Fuck Graham Plattner. Like this, I agree with everything you said. What is so infuriating about this is if he truly cared about getting people health care, about stopping a genocide, about making the economic and political system more fair in this country, none of those things can happen if we do not beat Susan Collins.
Exactly.
And by going down this path of conspiracy theories to disillusion supporters, he is making that less likely. He's making it harder to accomplish things he did. This video is Trumpian in its nature. It is conspiracy theories. It's denial. It's making it entirely about himself. You know, throughout this video, he talks about how the movement they built and how whatever the process is that the main Democratic Party comes up with, they must be true to that movement. Now, it is impressive for a first-time political candidate to beat the two-term governor of the state and beat the DSCC and Chuck Schumer and all that. That is an impressive thing. But like, just don't crawl so far up your own ass. Mm-hmm. You got 150,000 votes in Maine, right? This is not the Robert Kennedy 1968 campaign. This is not the Obama 2008 campaign. It is the smart thing for the party to do, to have a process that brings in the people who supported Graham Plattner, because we do obviously need them to win. But this whole thing that this was some magical messianic thing that he put together, that he himself and he put together, and it must pay respect to the what he did, is just fucking ridiculous. It's counterproductive. Just go away is the best thing he can do for the things he claims he cares about.
Of course he's waiting till Monday. It's like, first of all, time is of the essence. It's like paraphrasing the bear, every second counts. And this asshole is waiting till Monday just cause. Give me a fucking break.
Yeah, secondly, like, to what end?
To what, why? File the paperwork, be done. We need to move, everybody needs to move on. I say this in my newsletter and I genuinely believe it. Like, we have a long history here, but let this be like the last conversation we have to have about Graham Plattner, because the focus needs to be on Susan Collins.
And we're going to get to Susan Collins after we finish their next 15 minutes talking about
I think, I will say, and I've said this before, and I'm sure you agree with me on this, I'm sure, there needs to be at some point a real, I don't want to use proctology as the word, but like a real examination, a soul searching about the lessons learned here.
Oh, we're gonna do that today on this podcast in just a moment.
Bless you. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Oh yes, but let's, before we get to that, because I do want to have a conversation about how we got to this moment, and I want to talk a little bit about where you were right and I was wrong and why that was, which we will get to, I promise. But I want to talk a little bit first about what happens next. I previewed some of this on Polar Coaster, my show for Friends of the Pod subscribers. If you aren't a subscriber yet, I really don't know what you're doing with your life. And maybe you should visit crooked.com/friends to change that. But anyhow.
I'm a believer.
Provided that Plattner does formally drop out, the Maine Democratic Party has until July 27th to replace him. They've said they'll hold a convention to pick a new nominee. And we'll make all the details public soon, although there's been a lot of reporting on what it is, and they claim that transparency will be of the utmost importance. What do you make of the convention idea? Is there a better one, or is there a way not to make this process so messy?
Oh, when you get like, I'm the last one to have a better idea, but I would like to see, I mean, there's been talk about town halls and debates. I mean, I think there has to be some, before these delegates make the call, if it is in fact the leadership of the state party that is going to decide who the nominee is, one one would hope there would be some concession to both, you know, those delegates and the public in the sort of the and the notion of choice by having a full or full-ish airing of their views. And that's obviously going to have to be fairly abbreviated, but there needs to be some deference to, you know, helping educate the public and the delegates about who these people are. I've done a glancing search on the internet, but that's not sufficient. And they haven't had to talk about their positions in a fulsome way. So I think that, you know, there need, I would love to see some kind of public format where there, whether it's debate, town hall, whatever, that's moderated and that's, a, you know, official feeling beyond just interviews with the press and podcast appearances.
Yes. And so the way that we think this is going to happen is there would be this convention, and I think would sort of model what would be like a brokered convention at a national party convention in an election year. And there would be, I think it's upwards of 500 delegates. The 16, I believe, counties in Maine, county parties would elect delegates.
I think it's over 600 delegates. That's what
600 delegates from the 16 counties. And they will. So this is going to be party insiders under all circumstances. And like, I, there's just no way for to actual, you can't hold an election in this time period. So it's going to be this. This is going to be messy for sure. There's going to be, you know, candidates are going to try to, and we'll talk about who the candidates are in a second, but they're going to try to influence who the delegates are in all these places. They're going to put up slates. It's going to be messy. Now, this is probably the best process if you want to involve as many people as possible and have the most transparency, because the other alternative is the state party committee just votes.
No.
And, you know, this is we're in a weird, bizarro version of 2024 where we're losing a nominee very close to an election, about the same number of days, actually. And instead of what happened in 2024, where just one candidate automatically becomes a nominee, we're going to have a process of some kind, and these people are going to compete, and maybe one of them will come and stand out, and hopefully at the end of this process, we can come together. So there are no good answers here, I guess, is my point.
But you know what? I'm looking forward to the mess. I think everybody is hungry for some sense that there's a real choice and there are real races, and this is not a foregone conclusion on the part of party elders, and it's not a fait accompli. And Maine is pretty, my podcast, Runaway Country, we interviewed one of the people, Dan Kleben, who's, I know we're going to talk about this, one of the potential replacements for Plattner. And there is so much frustration at the idea that Washington and Chuck Schumer and outsiders and elders know better and have involved themselves in this race. There's real desire to have some openness in all of this, come what may.
Yeah. So as for who might run, potential candidates started testing the waters even before Plattner said he was leaving the race. Here's a small sample of how they're pitching themselves.
So I'm the only candidate that's demonstrated that I can win statewide with conservative Republicans and, you know, urban young people that are much more liberal.
Maine deserves a fighter in this seat, and I will be that fighter. I will fight for Medicare for all, because in the wealthiest country on earth, nobody should ever go bankrupt over a medical bill.
I own a small business here in Maine. I created, built it from the ground up out of my garage, you know, employ over 100 Mainers, pay a living wage, provide 100% of their health insurance coverage. I mean, I'm an outsider. I'm not an elected, I'm not a career politician. I've never held elected office.
That was former Maine Senate President Troy Jackson, the state's former top health official, Nirav Shah, and brewery owner Dan Kleben on your podcast, Alex, Runaway Country.
Indeed.
They've all said they will run. So have Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, former congressional candidate and political operative Jordan Wood, former Plattner staffer and congressional candidate Paige Loud, former Senate candidate David Costello. State Rep Valley Geiger is considering running too, although she hasn't officially said so. It's a lot of people. Do you find anyone compelling in this crowd? What do you make of them?
I mean, I talked to Dan Kleben, who's the bar owner, the brewery owner. No. Nothing goes together like oysters and beer. and he was going to run last. He has an interesting backstory insofar as he was going to run in last July and was told not to by the DSCC, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is, of course, under the aegis of the purview of Chuck Schumer, and is an example of just how fucked this process has been since its inception, right? And later dropped out of the race and endorsed when he entered the race, but Plattner had sort of won the hearts and minds of a lot of Mainers at that point. He subsequently endorsed the governor, Janet Mills, and then dropped out of the race. he's compelling as kind of a sort of surrogate for the everyman working class Mainer that Plattner represented, even if some of his biography was a bit hazy around the edges as far as his working class bona fides. Troy Jackson sounds like he's the person that most, you know, he's gotten an endorsement from Ro Khanna, who was a key endorsement for Grant Plattner, at least from a National Democrat. He, I believe, is a fifth generation logger from Allegash, which is like, bless Maine and all their outdoorsiness, brewers and oystermen and loggers. He's a former president of the Maine Senate. He has some experience. He's a, you know, I think he has the progressive bona fides that people are looking for. I got to stop saying the word bona fides. Nirav Shah is a really interesting one. He was acting, I think, director of the CDC for a minute as well.
Yes.
Which makes me a little worried, given that the CDC has become very politicized and, you know, former CDC director and someone who is going to be asked about COVID. It's just like, I am not a COVID, a vaccine denier or a COVID skeptic, but it's extra baggage in these insane and tumultuous times. I don't know. What do you think?
I am all tapped out on having opinions on Maine Senate candidates. the truth is, I don't know any of these people well enough to know who would be a good candidate. Sad thing is, we're not really going to know when it comes time to pick the person. This is a very abbreviated process. I hope there is someone in Democratic politics who is investing more than the $6,000 that the Yahoos who recruited Graham Plattner used to vet him and to do like full vets on all of these people so that everyone knows everything you possibly can know, because whoever this person is going to be under massive scrutiny. Because if like one of the tests will be, like normally a Maine Senate candidate does something, not obviously what Graham Plattner has been accused of here, but, you know, had some bad online, you know, in a different world, a different race, some bad online posts or something else, it'd be like a little speed bump. In this race with this level of scrutiny after what happened with Plattner will be giant news. So you got to make sure whoever we pick can withstand that scrutiny. I guess that's sort of the main thing.
Yeah. Two weeks, no big deal. Great time to do vetting, town halls, convention, no problem. But thank God Graham Plattner is waiting until Monday to drop out.
Yeah. Yeah. So because we definitely couldn't use the next 72 hours or so. It's fitting you're here for this episode because, as many of our listeners know, every time there's been big Graham Plattner news or Maine news, it's just been a coincidence. You and I have been on mic together, either on Pod Save America, on your podcast, on YouTube.
At one point, Dan, we talked about doing just a Maine Senate podcast.
Pod Save Maine. Yes,
we will not
be doing that now. Yes.
Pod Save the Maine. Why? If there's still a Senate race going on. Okay, I'm just kidding. We don't need to focus only on Maine.
But here's the important thing.
In the foxhole we've been.
Yes, we've talked about Maine more than anything else over the last year here.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. We're finally talking about mental health openly, but actually reaching out for help is still incredibly difficult. New data from BetterHelp confirms why. BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma report surveyed 2,000 Americans and revealed that 85% of Americans believe getting support is wise, yet 74% say society discourages people from doing so. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works, with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp's therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from there. Tailored, Rex, everybody should have therapy. You know, it's great to have therapy. People need it. It helps. Even if it's never been something you've tried before, it's always worth trying. Don't let stigma stand in the way of support. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/PSA. That's betterhelp.com/PSA.
Positive America is brought to you by Mint Mobile. There are things in life that you don't want to be transparent, like your swimsuit or your search history. You ain't lying. But when it comes to your wireless bill, transparency is everything. That's why Mint Mobile's wireless plans have no gimmicks and no gotchas, just high-speed data and reliable coverage on the T-Mobile 5G network. And right now, all plans are $15 a month, even unlimited. Mint Mobile took what's wrong with wireless and made it right with premium wireless for $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can even bring your current phone and your number. Choose from 3, 6, or 12-month plans and say goodbye to a monthly bill. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile. It's so easy. Sign up online and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/crooked. That's mintmobile.com/crooked. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/crooked. That's it. There's no catch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months. Plan required. $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage vary. See mintmobile.com.
And it needs to be said, you've been a Platner skeptic from the beginning, the very beginning, before anyone, before the Reddit post came out, before the tattoo, before the more recent stuff, you were a Platner skeptic. And I will say here that you were right and I was wrong.
I don't want to be right, man. I did not. This is not about me being right and you being wrong. Was I even right? I don't even know what that means.
Well, you were right to be skeptical of Grant Platner.
I guess I was skeptical of Grant.
Would you like to take a victory lap?
Want to take a victory lap. This is not a good moment first of all, it's not a good moment for Grant Platner. It's not a good moment for the women that he allegedly tormented and assaulted. It's not a good moment for the Democratic Party, because I think we're at a real crossroads here in terms of how the Democratic Party manages candidate recruitment and what it means to answer the toxic masculinity of MAGA. And it's not a good moment because the focus has been taken off of Susan Collins. And so it's hard to take a victory lap. I mean, I hope out of this, there's a little bit. The thing about Graham, I was not like some sage and like saw into the future or anything, but I was always just the bro glow was a little bit, I didn't get it. I didn't like the way, I was never a Janet Mills supporter, but I didn't like, people summarily dismissed her. And I felt
I summarily dismissed her.
Not to say that she should be the nominee, but I feel like there's like there was always like latent misogyny around it. And I felt like, you know, in the retrospect, and maybe this is just hindsight's 2020 or whatever, but there are a lot of women in a lot of places who were like never really that on board and kind of felt a little bit sheepish saying, I don't know about that guy. He seems kind of like an asshole. I mean, yeah. I got into fights with Platner supporters, you know, where the context of the conversation was he has talent. He might be able to get the job done, but he seems like a dick. And there was a real, and like the dickishness may not just be a sort of side effect of ambition, but may be like a more complicated and potentially serious character flaw. And as it turns out, I think that's what it was. This is someone who's completely self-absorbed to the point of maybe almost like a certain psychosis based on that exit video, and certainly has some demons he really needs to wrestle with.
Yeah, you know, when I say summarily dismissed Mills, let me say what my actual real position was, because this is sort of how you and I first had this conversation. Mm-hmm. Janet Mills gets in the race. The DSCC endorses her 5 minutes later. Chuck Schumer endorses her. And we know at the time that the DSCC has been trying to clear the field for Janet Mills, telling people like Hannah Pingree and these other candidates in Maine to run for governor, not run for Senate, because Janet Mills is the chosen candidate of the Democratic establishment. My view at the time was that I thought that was a big mistake for the DSCC, that if the DSCC is going to get involved in a primary, they better be 100% certain that they have the best candidate. And I didn't think you could look at what happened with Susan Collins in 2020, what happened in the country in 2024, and declare beyond a shadow of a doubt that a 79-year-old unpopular two-term governor was our best bet. I wasn't convinced Graham Platner was a better bet, but I thought the voters of Maine should pick it up. Now, I was intrigued by Platner for sure. I'm not going to take that, not going to dispute that. Like, I've been thinking a lot because I was wrong here. I don't like being wrong. It happens a lot. But I've really tried to think about where I erred in this. And there are a couple of places, I'll say what those were. The first is, if I have a bias, or you can even say a blind spot in politics, it's for outsider candidates who did not grow up their entire life wanting to be in office.
Yeah.
Like, that's why I like Barack Obama over Hillary Clinton. That's why I really loved Beto O'Rourke when he was running for Senate and was intrigued by his potential as presidential candidate. It's why I supported Mallory McMorrow in the Michigan Senate race this cycle. That's what gets me most interested are candidates like that. I think they have the potential to be the best candidates and they can make the best leaders because they're just like more, they've lived a normal life. They're more human. They talk more like a human and they're less risk averse. You know, the people who spent their whole lives deciding like what mistakes not to make to avoid cutting off their path to higher office generally are not
living
the best
authentic
leaders.
Lives.
Yes. And I think that makes you a better candidate. It absolutely does. Now that will blow up in your face a bunch because those candidates are by definition higher risk. They have higher ceilings and lower floors. And so that's why I was intrigued by Plattner. Like I thought to beat Susan Collins, you needed a higher variance candidate, someone who could do something different than Sarah Gideon did or all of the people who came before. And I was not convinced that Janet Mills could do that. And I do believe that was actually the right call. Not that Plattner was the right person. Obviously he was not, but that Janet Mills was the wrong candidate.
Well, and we see that now. That's borne out in polling that we have even now.
And, you know, and so, and then the thing that I feel I'm mad at myself about is, you know, as we went through this process, when you and I first had this conversation there, we knew nothing about Plattner. And then we saw the online posts and, you know, was the things he said were horrible. And I thought there was a real chance that could be disqualifying both in the primary and the general to voters. Right. But I did believe naively, apparently, the story he told about being a person who was dealing with PTSD at a dark time in their life in drinking and did a bunch of things and then changed their life, improved. And I do believe that we should leave space for people who make mistakes to still be in politics. Right.
Of course. I think redemption and empathy are like things we need to cultivate as a society beyond politics.
And I actually still believe this, the story he told about how he got the tattoo was true. Now, what I've come to like, I do not believe that he knew it was a Nazi tattoo. And I certainly don't believe he was a secret Nazi
I'm with Tim Miller on this, though. Yes. I think he got it, then figured out what it was, and then kind of used it as a like, you know, a cocktail point. Look at my Nazi tattoo.
I think he
certainly
lied
about
I think he lied about when he discovered that it was a Nazi tattoo. That I have come to believe. But I don't, this is a guy who was not shy about sharing his opinions online. So I feel like if he really was a Nazi, we would know that. Now you could say that the Nazi tattoo, one thing people say is anyone who gets a Nazi tattoo for whatever reasons has bad judgment. And that may be, but a lot of people in their 20s, when they're on leave from war and drunk, have bad judgment. And should that be?
You have a Celtic band around your forcep, right?
I have no tattoos. So
I have a bunch of back tattoos, a bunch of butterflies that I regret now.
They're not the shamrock
on my ankle. I love
They're not Nazi butterflies, correct?
No, I actually have no back tattoos, just for the fucking
record.
I don't know. I'm not that girl, Dan. I don't have a toe ring.
Anywho, but the other thing I regret, and this is where I really started to get very worried about Grant Plattner was when the story came out in May about him sexting other women while married. And it's not that people can't make mistakes in their marriage and still run for office. That happens all the time. It was that happened so recently that it really brought into question the redemption story that I had naively believed from him. Right. It's one thing to make mistakes in a different part of your life. And then the story he told us, he made a bunch of mistakes. He changed his life. He started working. He got into politics. But that wasn't the story. That wasn't the reality. But even then, it was like his wife said they worked through it with counseling. We all followed their fertility journey together. Like, it just seemed like they had put it behind them. But it really made me wonder, like, what the next thing was, right? And
then he lied to everybody. Yeah. He lied to everybody.
But the thing when I look back on all of that, is don't believe a liar is a really like that's not helpful advice because you don't know someone's a liar until you find out later. What I think I should have paid more attention to was that back in March, you and I did a Political Experts React where we were looking at ads that were running in that race. This included the first negative ad that Janet Mills launched against Plattner, which had a bunch of women. reacting to the things that Plattner had posted. And the one that really, and you made this point to me, and it really has been in my head for the last few weeks here, is like what he said about minimizing rape and that sort of inherent misogyny should have been a much bigger flag. Like that is a sign of something else. I wish I'd paid more attention to that in this discussion. And yeah. that was separate and apart from some of the other things that he said that were just stupid and offensive. That was dangerous and offensive.
That just for, I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit, but that was the Reddit post where he said people should take some responsibility, not get so fucked up that they end up having sex with someone they don't mean to, which is deeply ironic considering the allegations against him. Yeah. Can I ask you something, Dan? Yeah, and I genuinely don't know what I think about this because we talk a lot about Schumer and obviously this was just a totally fakakta situation where the DSEC is intervening to grade the detriment of the race. But like Chuck Schumer is also picking candidates in a lot of other swing states and in the, putting the heft of the DSEC behind people like Mary Peltola and Roy Cooper and Sherrod Brown and people who are good candidates for those races. And maybe they would have gotten there regardless of Schumer's involvement. But like, are we, and I genuinely don't have an answer to this. Are we focused on this because he just did such a colossally bad fucking job picking the candidate in this race?
What he did in Alaska, North Carolina, and Ohio was he recruit candidates who could clear the field themselves. They were candidates so good, so well-known, so universally believed to be the best candidate that no one ran against him. So it wasn't like there were a bunch of other people running. That Janet Mills was not that candidate. She was an
unpopular
Janet
Mills didn't even want to run.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? And also, Maine is a state with lots of Democrats. Alaska, you know, there's only one. The recruitment list for Alaska was Mary Peltola. There was no one else, right? It was Peltola or bust. Ohio, it was Sherrod Brown, and there was a long gap between one and two on that list. North Carolina, you got a few more Democrats who could have run, but Roy Cooper was far at the top of that list. So once you got those, was it? It's where I didn't like what they did in Michigan, backing Haley Stevens.
There's a Texas element of all this as well that could end up not working out very well. Who knows?
Yeah. My general view is Chuck Schumer, the DSEC, whoever else, should recruit candidates. They should, if they think someone's the best, Chuck Schumer's on the phone to try to convince them to do it. They should do that. When there was an active primary going on and then they put their thumb on the scale and they take that choice away from the voters. Now, when I first wrote this and was first upset about it, it's because the DSEC-backed candidate always won the primary. Politics has changed so much in the last 2 years that that's actually become an albatross around people's necks as opposed to like this huge asset. But at the time it was you're the DSEC could pick the candidate and essentially take the agency away from the voter, which is what they were trying to do in Maine. That did not work in Maine. And so it's like, it's not that the DSEC and Schumer were wrong in every instance. It's just, they were wrong in this one.
Yeah. Well, and the dynamics of it are particular and the outcome could have been meaningfully different if Chuck Schumer hadn't tried to clear the field and do what he did. And in fact, I think in some ways elevate Plattner in the course of all of that, right? He became a poster child for defiance and grassroots activism and you know, saying fuck you to politics as usual. So
the same thing happened in Michigan, where by putting the thumb on the scale for Haley Stevens, he elevated Abdul. And then one of the worst things that happened to Malik Morrow was a report, I think in Politico or somewhere else, that said Schumer would be fine with either Haley or Mallory. So all of a sudden, Abdul got to go out and say all the time, I'm the only candidate that Chuck Schumer opposes in this race.
And continues to say that like yesterday.
The thing I've been struggling with this conversation, and this has been it's not been a fun time online for a podcast associated with Graham Plattner.
Speak for yourself. I'm just kidding. Yes.
No, I mean, as you should, have your moment.
It hasn't been fun.
I've tried to struggle with what like the broader lesson is here. Because it shouldn't be that outsider candidates are bad.
But or Dan, that can't, you're, or that you're speaking so broadly. Like this guy, you didn't have to know that he was a dick from the beginning. But once the Reddit posts started coming out, like,
right.
I'm all right for redemption, but there were a lot of data points.
That is the true. But I think what I'm saying, like, for example, there was this Biden aide who's on CNN today, who is saying, basically taking Plattner, comparing him to Abdul El-Sayed and saying like also unvetted, same consultants. And well, it's just absurd because Abdul has run for governor and has been a government official in Michigan for a while. So that's an absurd comparison. But is this idea that people who are outsiders or first-time candidates are inherently risky because they haven't been tested, they haven't been vetted by the system.
Right. That's right? What I mean. And nobody should take a broad lesson about outsiders from the Plattner.
Yes, debacle. Because here were two other people who have had huge sexual misconduct, sexual assault problems, who are the insider candidates of Eric Swalwell and Andrew Cuomo.
Right.
Right. There's nothing about being a creep that is exclusive to first-time candidates. It's also true. I mean, the other thing that, you know, the other, as we think about this and like what it all means, like one story that people can tell, and it's not an incorrect story, is that a bunch of podcast bros and Democratic strategists and other dumb men online fell for the shtick of this narcissist, right? And that it was true that a lot of women and a lot of women in my life that I regret not listening to, like you and Sarah Longwell and other people who mm-hmm. have raised these flags, you know, and this was like dumb men and much more safe for women. And they're in the loudest voices, I think, criticizing Plattner, particularly nationally, were women. But then you look in Maine and Plattner was beating Mills by like 15 points among women. A majority of that 150,000 right. votes was women. And so I was just reading Rebecca Tracer's very insightful piece and thoughtful piece about her support of Graham Plattner.
Well, right? Michelle Goldberg has one as well.
Yeah.
Can I say something? Well, to your point about the podcast bros and other guys, I think, and I feel like I always sound like, a Brown University professor when I say this, there's a real crisis right now in terms of how the left responds to MAGA-style masculinity and like what it means to be tough and a warrior, but also progressive and a populist. And like, what is that special alchemy? And like, we got the left needs to build that person. They need someone who can be the antidote to all the just utterly toxic garbage male sort of the masculinity that is being showcased on the right, which is ultra retrograde, misogynist, and bad for the country, setting aside bad for women. And like Plattner was a unicorn in that way. He felt like, okay, here's someone who's legitimately a progressive and he's a man's man and all this. And that was, I think, intoxicating to a group of men in particular who are looking for that answer. And it may be a latent desire, it may be an explicit desire, but I do think as a dude in the world who's a progressive, it's a weird, complicated time, which doesn't mean we should overly focus on men. I get it. But it is a problem. I mean, I have two boys. Like, there is a dearth of real kind of like, there's no playbook for how to be a guy in this moment. And I think if you're in the world of politics and you're in media, you're kind of you're bouncing between archetypes and you're trying to figure out like, okay, what's the way to be? What should we be supporting and championing? And Plattner was very attractive in that way. And I think that's part of the reason he took off, at least in the online media space, in a way that, I mean, Mills never was going to, but even other guys in American politics haven't. I mean, he was just incredibly compelling in that way.
I mean, he was an excellent communicator. If you listen to his interviews, like we did the New York Times podcast, like the interview he did with our friend Ben Rhodes about post 9/11 wars, he was interesting and thoughtful, and obviously like how he looked and how he sounded, you know, affected that, but it just was all bullshit is the problem, right?
Yeah, no, he's a pig.
Yeah.
And that's what's so devastating is like, oh, what turns out actually like that brand of machismo is totally corrupted, which is
or this
his I particular guess, his
this
machismo
this particular yes. vehicle, like there was something Plattner was offering both in Maine and nationally that was compelling to a lot of people.
Yeah.
The problem was that the person who was offering that was Graham Plattner. Right. And so like, how do you like, it's like, we have to spend some time and we're not going to do it here. We can't do it here over time. Just figuring out like, what was it? I don't want to overstate how important this was. Once again, it's 150,000 fucking people in Maine. This is not, you know,
Right. You know, but I mean, this was movement. Someone whose, his advisor said that he could run for president in 2020. This wasn't going to end in Maine.
Yes. But every I've been around a lot of Senate candidates. Consultants sell it to every fucking person
because they
all want them to, because it's very much in every consultant's interest. Everyone wants to be David Axelrod, James Carville, you know, Karl Rove. And so they're looking for those people all the time. It doesn't mean they actually would, but he was a national phenomenon. He broke out in a way that, like, I mean, this is a bad example, but in a way that, you know, Stacey, this is a good example. Stacey Abrams did, even though she didn't win, the way that Beto broke out. And so it's like, yeah, they're like, there was something there. And it's like, what was that? And how do you try to figure out what that is that's separate from the very damaged, very fucked up person, the pig, as you said, you do this. Okay. Enough of Graham Plattner. How much damage do you, like, how fucked are we in Maine after all of this? Do we, like, what kind of shot do you think we have against Susan Collins now?
I think, and I think my advice would be, say the word Susan Collins every time you want to say Graham Plattner, over and over and over again, because she is weak, but she is going to be a challenge. We don't need to go into the numbers. We've talked about them a lot, but she overperforms, or she has, in most elections she's been in recently. This is the first one she's going to have to face voters since Roe fell. So, and I think that that's legit in a state that's, what, 60% of the electorate is female. You know, hopefully people remember the fact that she built the Supreme Court that overturned Roe. She was the critical vote in the Kavanaugh confirmation and fancies herself a moderate, which is complete horseshit. I don't know, Dan. I mean, I think that the fact that I take it as a positive sign that, in a way, that Maine voters are so desperate, or they're so fired up about getting Susan Collins out, that they were willing to overlook the initial phase of Graham Plattner's very serious transgressions. I mean, that's, I guess, the silver lining, right? But, you know, the party's got to manage this process in a way that doesn't further disillusion Democratic voters. Graham Plattner needs to shut the fuck up. And the focus really needs to return like a laser to Susan Collins.
I think if we can, now this is me being glass half full, if we can pick the right person, and the right person might just be someone named generic Democrat with no tattoos and who's never been, who doesn't know how to get to Reddit. we are in a better place than we would have been with either Graham Plattner let's say that this accusation never happened, where Graham Plattner would have been everything we knew up until 2 days ago, that we have potential for this new person to be stronger than that, and stronger than Janet Mills would have been.
Yeah.
Because even like in that New York Times stand-up poll from 2 weeks ago, after all the sexting stuff and all this came out, Graham Plattner was still more popular than Janet Mills. And so we have a chance here. Now, this is a state where, using that same New York Times poll, Democrats lead the generic ballot by 11 points. They want the Senate to be in Democratic hands by 11 points, I believe, 11 or 12 points. So there is like, and this is a state that's more Democratic than 2020. A lot of people who profile as Democratic voters moved to Maine, particularly to the Portland area, starting around COVID. So it's actually a state that has grown from in-migration. So we should still be able to win the race. It's going to be really fucking hard. Collins is going to have so much money. She's had to spend almost none of it. There's going to be a gazillion dollars.
Big war chest.
And PAC money. But I do think there's a chance we can make this all, like, every, this is the, what I was saying. This is my unsolicited advice to the Plattner people 2 weeks ago, which was like all this Epstein Island, you know, reordering politics, populism stuff, is like, all that matters is that Susan Collins, no matter what else you feel about her, a vote for her is a vote to let Donald Trump control the Senate and pick Supreme Court justices. That's it. It doesn't matter how you feel about her. It doesn't matter if you liked her personally. It doesn't matter if she got money for the Iron Bath Works or whatever else. She is, a vote for her is a vote
for
to let Donald Trump pick two more Supreme Court justices. Full stop. Just, like, that's what people care about. That's what it's about. Don't let it be about anything else. Don't overcomplicate the fucking simple. So I think I do believe we can still win this. It'll be hard.
Totally agree. And I had interviewed Adam Gentleson, former deputy chief of staff to Harry Reid and chief of staff to John Fetterman in the podcast. And he is aligned with you that this makes the Democrats' chances are better now than they were a week ago when Plattner was still in the race before the Politico reporting. So,
So
there's that.
There's that.
That was like a therapy session, Dan.
I've had a lot to say for a few days here, so I'm glad we
I feel very honored that you wanted to share those things with me.
I'm actually, if John was not on vacation, I would have suggested that we swap him out for you. I feel better doing this with you.
Oh my God. Well, thanks. So, I mean, we've gone on a long road to together.
It's been a long, strange main journey. Yes.
Yeah, we have.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Built. We can all agree that housing is expensive. Rent, mortgage, it doesn't matter which one you're paying. It stings every month. But Built can make it feel a little better. Let's explain. Built started out rewarding members on their rent. As of 2026, Built members can also earn points on mortgage payments, too. Every housing payment earns you points, so you can use with top travel partners like United and Hyatt, or use your points toward Lyft rides, Amazon purchases, and so much more. You could take a fitness class. You can get a gift card at 120 brands. But here's the most underrated part. Built members also get access to a neighborhood concierge. It can make restaurant reservations, book fitness classes, and find new local spots, all while being rewarded at more than 45,000 merchant partners. It's like having a personal assistant baked into where you live. It's simple. Being a renter and now owning a home is better with Built. Join the membership for where you live at joinbuilt.com/crooked. That's joinbilt.com/crooked. Make sure to use our URL so they know we sent you.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Cook Unity.
I love Cook Unity.
Can I tell you about a couple delicious looking Cook Unity items? Yasa grilled chicken. It's Yasified technically, no? With sweet plantains. So it's like chicken, some grains, some plantains. And then how about this one? Sriracha honey glazed salmon bites with a kale crunch salad.
Wow.
That's just a perfect meal.
I had a gyro from Cook Unity before work today.
Delicious.
That's what I ate after the gym.
Everyone's like, what is Cook Unity? Cook Unity is the first chef-led meal delivery service that makes your meals in small batches inside local micro kitchens, teeny tiny kitchens, across the U.S., not in factories, so every dish arrives with the kind of freshness you get at the restaurant itself. Meals from Michelin-starred chefs, James Beard winners, and Food Network stars. Go to cookunity.com/crooked or use the code crooked before checkout for 50% off your first week. Every Cook Unity meal is handcrafted by chefs in local micro kitchens, not mass-produced, fresh, never frozen, and can be refrigerated for up to 7 days. The food tastes like someone just made it for you because someone just did in a small batch that morning. There are hundreds of dishes to choose from, and the menu is updated constantly. Taste what happens when real award-winning chefs make fresh, small batch.
Taste what happens.
Small batch meals just for you. Go to cookunity.com/crooked. Enter the code crooked before checkout to get 50% off your first order. That's 50% off your first order by using the code crooked or going to cookunity.com/crooked.
All right, now let's turn to a new story of interest to just slightly more people than the main Senate race, the war with Iran, which seems to be close to restarting any minute now. Ships transiting the Strait of Hormuz started coming under fire again earlier this week. On Tuesday, the U.S. military responded by hitting targets in Iran and reimposing sanctions on Iranian oil. Iran responded to that with shots at American installations in the Middle East. We responded to that with more strikes and so on and so on. It's all a giant mess and getting worse by the hour. The good news is that Donald Trump seems to have a very good handle on all of this. Here he is at this week's NATO summit in Turkey.
Is the ceasefire over? Is the ceasefire done? Is the MOU dead?
It's a very interesting question. To me, I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore, they're scum.
We had 111 missiles shot by the Islamic Republic of Japan.
The Islamic Republic of Japan.
That's a headline story. I didn't even know. Japan.
I mean, not only has Japan become Islamic, they're also at war with the United States right now. So,
so much happened while I was focused on Grand Platter.
We've been so knee-deep in main politics, we missed a lot of stuff around the world. So I'm sure Tommy and Ben covered this.
Well, thank God. Thank God we have them on watch.
Yes. Things seem to be going well in the Middle East, huh?
Totally. The line out of the White House is, this is according to Axios, I think today, we're going to slap Iran around a bit so they understand we're not fucking around. That's the goal. That's the strategy here. They are saying that this next stage of war could be weeks, could be months. But the essence of this, Dan, is that Iran is not happy about the way things are going in the Strait of Hormuz, and they want to reclaim control of it. And that is an unresolved dispute that is going to continue to fuck the global economy and could make it life incredibly painful for Republicans heading into the midterms. And so, I mean, the idea that anything was resolved by a page and a half DocuSign, however many weeks ago that was, is a joke, as is this administration's foreign policy. I am not surprised that we are here. I also am unclear as to how any of this resolves itself, given the utterly, we are at loggerheads with the Iranians over the strait. They want ships to pass through on their side of the strait and register with the, wait for it, Hormuz Transit Authority. Can someone get me an HTA hat? And instead, the U.S. is like, because that's how they're gonna tax people or toll people or companies as they go through the strait. And the U.S. is like, you know, go the southern route. Don't register with the HTA. Use the side of the strait where Oman rules the water, if you will. That's not going over well with the Iranians, and now we're back at war because the fundamental issue at the heart of this is nowhere close to being resolved.
The Wall Street Journal had a story that said that this is all basically happening because Section 5 of the ceasefire agreement that I would say Trump signed at Versailles is poorly written and has led to a lot of confusion about what Iranian control of the strait actually means. And so
they never really worked it out because it was a page and a half, because it's a joke, because there was no diplomatic process. And it's just that they wanted to get gas prices down. And
they wanted to say the strait was open so that the market would improve and oil prices would start to go down, even if the strait was not actually open.
It's insane. Now, gas prices have ticked up a little bit. They're not where they used to be. But, you know, when you are so ambiguous about what the goal is, how this could possibly resolve itself, the diplomatic process seems, I don't know, he says they're cuckoo, I'm done dealing with them, they're sickos. Like, I mean, half of that is bluster or three quarters of it is bluster, but I've never been that confident in Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff negotiating this process, though they are a crackerjack team of diplomats. And like, what confidence should we have that this doesn't stretch on, off and on, not being called a war forever? The only thing standing in Trump's way, I guess, is the appropriations process and the fact that he's asking Congress for another $350 billion, and Republicans may not be super stoked on doing that 4 months before the midterms.
Yeah, this goes to the point I like to make about this, which is anyone dumb enough to start this war is too dumb to get out of it, which is sort of where we are.
Totally.
As you pointed out, oil prices and gas prices have gone up a little bit through this. The stock market's gone down. Ships are still passing through the strait, although it's still well below pre-war levels.
One third of pre-war levels.
But the administration has finally taken at least one step to help with gas prices. Let's take a look.
We're here at the first Freedom Fuel Network gas station right here in Philadelphia, leading the charge to lower gas prices. $3.47. That's for our 47th president, President Donald J. Trump.
When I saw it, I thought it was fake news, but I'm glad it's true. Thanks a lot, Trump. Just keep doing what you're doing. Doing a good job.
Thank you, President Trump.
Thank you for helping our country.
It's President Donald J. Trump leading the charge to lower gas prices right here at Freedom Fuel Network's gas stations.
You heard that right. The administration's big move is a network of so-called Freedom Fuel stations that are mostly in the larger Philadelphia area, and they are selling gas at $3.47 a gallon, 47 cents. Get it? Alex, I believe you have some thoughts on this initiative, and I'm going to clear out and let you have them.
Okay. First of all, nobody knows who's behind these gas stations. They've just like popped up around the Philly area. They used to be like Sunoco stations or Texaco stations. There's just like giant stickers on them. And nobody knows how they're pricing gas at $3.47 because newsflash, the reason gas prices are high is not because gas owners are stubborn and just need to be convinced, get on the bandwagon of cheap gas. It's because they have to be because the market is at where it's at. Now, there's some discretion they have in terms of cents. And like, you know, on the margins. But when gas is over $4 a gallon, it's not because they've gotten greedy. It's because that's where the market is. That's where the price of crude. So this is all smoke and mirrors. This is like a gas station Potemkin village. Like it's and like I sort of delight in it because it is further proof that Donald Trump is a socialist. Like these gas stations or gas station owners are clearly getting some kind of government subsidy to lower gas to $3.47. It is meaningfully lower than other area gas stations. And it fits in the suite of decisions Donald Trump has made to have the heavy hand of government get involved in private enterprise, whether that's, you know, extorting NVIDIA and Intel for stock that the government controls in order to get licenses in order to establish trading overseas, whether that's the tariffs, whether that's the heavy hand of the Trump administration involved in the media and censorship. I mean, this is all the behavior of, I don't know, like someone like Maduro or Putin or take your pick. This is not what free market capitalism is supposed to look like. It is socialism, sometimes communism, maybe outright fascism and authoritarianism under the guise as when it is politically convenient. What a joke.
It's also stupid. Like, yes. what possible world is this going to make a difference by having like a handful of gas stations in the Philadelphia area sell gas for a short period of time for a slightly cheaper than other parts of the, like it is, they are spitting in the ocean.
Yeah. There are like tens of thousands of gas stations across the country.
There is a saying when you work in the White House, it's like, you want to get caught trying. Like, there are problems you can't solve. They're too big. Congress won't work, but you want people to see you're trying. This isn't even qualified as trying. They sent this video out saying they're doing this. And then in 99% of the rest of the country, people who see the video are then going to drive to the gas station and gas is going to be the same high price it was before. So you've just angered them because somehow then where you are not valuable enough to get one of these Freedom Fuel stations, you still have to pay the normal price. It's just so stupid. It's all dumb. It's all dumb.
I think it's honestly for Trump. Do you know what I mean? I think it's just a video that they can play for him. When the baby gets angry, it's like one of those soothing, like it's one of those, there are these little gummy toys you can give babies. They can chew on when they're teething and they get angry. This is the sort of video version of that.
What this is? This is Coco Melon for fascist idiots. Yeah,
that's exactly what it is.
Okay. All right. One more consequence of the Iran situation we wanted to mention. Trump flew his new Qatari gifted Air Force One to Turkey. But when it was time to leave, he announced that he was sending the jet onto an airbase in England to give Americans stationed there a chance to tour the aircraft. And that, quote, for old time's sake, he'd be following in the old plane. He was, of course, lying. The New York Times reported that the Secret Service urged him to take the old plane because it was more secure and the new version doesn't have the same defensive capabilities. Alex, I thought the new Air Force One, which we paid hundreds of millions of dollars, we, the taxpayers, paid hundreds of millions of dollars to rush into service, was totally safe and perfect. Are you shocked by this?
Shocked, Dan. I did not realize that when Trump, first of all, he has two jets in rotation, and I believe there are two more under construction right now. So it's not like the entrance of this free Qatari jet did anything to help the American taxpayer or saved us any money. I direct you to John Lovett and Tommy Vitor's excellent YouTube conversation on this very topic, which I found quite enlightening. Clearly the jet is not up to snuff. Maybe they spent all the money on like warm nuts that are served right before, right after takeoff, or lie flat seats, or, really fancy in-flight amenities like face mist. I don't know. But it wasn't on securing the jet the way it needs to be, because clearly they believed that there was some kind of national security threat flying out of Turkey. They asked people on Air Force One to lower their blinds, which I guess, according to Tommy, is what you do in a war zone, and that the Qatari jet did not have significant missile defense systems on it to keep everybody safe. So they had to fly the old baby blue Air Force One out of the threat zone. That's a problem. You don't want to have two jets in rotation because one isn't actually up to, isn't secure enough. Well, generally speaking, you want the president to be on the safe jet all the time.
Because like there's another version of this, right? Which is the Air Force One exists the way it does. It's built the way it's built. Because in the event, this idea came during the Cold War, which is there is a nuclear war or some other war, and the president has to stay in the air for hours and hours and hours, be able to fly anywhere in the world to get to safety and be able to command the U.S. military forces from there. And so you can't, like, at any point he could be on the new jet. And theoretically, something can happen in the world that could put him at risk. But you're on the new jet. It's not a commuter shuttle.
No.
It's like once again, and this whole thing is so dumb because the jet, he doesn't care about that because it's not that often that the president is actually targeted like this, obviously, or that he is within ballistic missile range of Iran. But because he takes the jet with him when he leaves. That's the thing. This jet does not go to President Josh Shapiro, AOC, Kamala Harris, whoever else comes next, it goes to Donald Trump to fly around on as he visits golf clubs around the world.
Fantastic. Yeah. Trump Force One.
Trump Force One.
What a disaster, but what else? I mean, everything Trump touches turns to shit. So that's here we right. are.
When we come back, North Carolina Senate candidate, former governor, Roy Cooper.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Article. Article makes it effortless to build a home that lasts without the boutique markup. Their curated collections of mid-century, coastal, and Scandi furniture are designed to mix and match perfectly so you can create a cohesive designer look that will stand the test of time. Article stuff, it looks great. Mm-hmm. It's quite simple and modern, so it'll fit with a lot of different design styles, but it just looks really good. Article offers fast, affordable shipping across the U.S. and Canada with options for professional assembly. If you prefer a hands-off experience, have a question or need help with your design choices, Article's customer care team is available 7 days a week, offering knowledgeable support and even free interior design services to help you get your home just right. With Article's 30-day satisfaction guarantee, you can shop with confidence, knowing that if you're not completely in love with your new furniture, you can easily return it. This peace of mind ensures you can invest in your home without hesitation. Article is offering our listeners $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit article.com/crooked, and the discount will automatically be applied at checkout. Out. That's article.com/crooked for $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more.
Joining me now is the Democratic nominee for one of the most important Senate races this cycle, former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper. Governor Cooper, welcome back to Pod Save America.
I'm glad to be with you, Dan. Thanks a lot.
It's been a while, so it's great to have you on here. North Carolina, a state near and dear to my heart, has been breaking Democratic hearts for a long time. It's been since 2008, since a Democrat won a Senate seat there. Talk to me about why you believe 2026 is going to be different than all the other cycles that have emotionally traumatized so many Democrats around the country and in North Carolina, I assume.
Well, Dan, I've been having to convince people that we are having a tough race because people ask me what my biggest fear is, and that a lot of people have put this race in the checkmark win column. And you and I know the history of North Carolina. Just because I have a lead in the polls doesn't mean this race isn't going to be very close. We've seen so many Democratic candidates have a lead, have a lead, have a lead until they don't. And we see Republican money pouring into this state at the end, and we see great Democratic candidates lose by a couple of points. And as you know, it's been 2008 since we won a seat. Almost 40 years, we've only had two Democrats, and both of them served one term. So this is going to be a close race. I think this is different because people are hurting now. I don't think I've seen it like this because I've been out on my Make Stuff Cost Less tour. People are telling me that there's just too much month at the end of the money for them. Their paychecks just are not keeping up with the cost of living, and they are frustrated, and they recognize that Washington, D.C. is in chaos, that this president and administration promised them that day one, the cost of living would be on top of the list. And not only has it not been, they've actively hurt people's chances in that we've seen these chaotic tariffs add cost to everything. We've seen this war in Iran increase costs. We've seen this one big beautiful bill that ripped healthcare away from people and given the tax breaks to the billionaires. People are frustrated. And at the end of the day, I think they know that I will be a senator who will put the people first, not the billionaires. And we know that my opponent, Michael Whatley, will do and say whatever this president tells him to do and say. And we know at the end of the day that a lot of money is going to come into North Carolina, but we're going to win this race because we have to. I told my children the other day that my parents left me a better country, but that we had work to do to leave them a better country. And I think all of us need to look within us and say, hey, what can I do to make sure that this country is the kind of country we want to leave to our kids and grandkids? And that's why I'm running for the Senate.
You point out affordability is the number one issue in North Carolina. It's the number one issue all around the country. It's frankly the number one issue in our politics for basically since COVID, as inflation went up. As you mentioned, you're on this tour of North Carolina. Tell me a little about the tour. And can you give me a handful of specific ideas that you would do to help lower people's prices if elected?
Well, the tour, I've been meeting people across North Carolina. We call it the Make Stuff Cost Less Tour.
Very clear. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we hear from Kiwana, who's struggling to pay for groceries. She's a teacher. We hear from Meredith, whose kid, Vivi's on Medicaid, and Meredith's scared death that Washington is going to attack and take away Vivi's health care. Pender's a farmer in rural North Carolina. The tariffs are killing him. So in my policy proposals, you can go to roycooper.com and read our proposals on what we're proposing to do to make stuff cost less. You can also help us out. You can also volunteer. We need people to help us in this campaign. But first, you know, we've got to work with Republicans, and I believe there'll be some who will be ready to work with us on taking back the legislative branch's constitutional authority here. Checks and balances are critical. So taking them back on trade and tariffs, we got to roll back these chaotic tariffs. And I think immediately that helps to reduce the cost of living. We got to restore the health care cuts that have really wreaked havoc on people's pocketbooks and people's lives, their health. We've got to make sure that we are investing in education across the board. I believe that when you look at all of the proposals that we have made, like a child care tax credit, because I'm hearing from people about child care going through the roof and they're having to make hard decisions about whether one parent's going to work. We just need a Washington focused on people and not tax breaks for the corporations. And I think that we can make a difference. A government that works can make a difference for people and help them have a paycheck that keeps up with the cost of living.
There's been a lot of talk about groceries and gas, of course, and gas because of the Iran war, but is utility prices. And one of the things driving up utility prices is data centers. What would you do with data centers to either help lower the cost of electricity, slow the build out of these? Like, how are you thinking about this sort of mad rush to build as many data centers as possible?
It's part of my policy proposals is that they must pay for their own energy. Other consumers should not have to bear any cost from data centers. And we should encourage them to create their own energy sources and connect them to the grid. And I think many of them are ready to step up and do that. Of course, communities have to have input as to whether these are built there or not. But I think that is critical because we now have a demand for power unlike anything we've ever seen. And we have a Congress and a president in Washington that has wiped away the gains that we made in clean energy that would have helped add energy to the grid. That's all been wiped away during the last couple of years. So we have a real challenge on our hands. So I think they have to make sure that they pay for their own.
Your opponent, Michael Whatley, is not particularly well known to a lot of people around the country. He's not sort of one of these, you know, MAGA bad guys like a Ken Paxton or a Herschel Walker or a Dr. Oz in previous elections. I understand there's some debate about his North Carolina roots and that he failed to be able to name any members of your NHL Stanley Cup championship team down there. But what should voters either in North Carolina or around the country want to help your campaign know about Michael Whatley and who he is and what he would do?
Well, first, he's been a Washington, D.C. insider for years. He was a big oil and utility company lobbyist. He worked to be able to raise prices for oil companies and raise utility rates for utility companies. He still owns stock in those. And he served as chair of the Republican National Committee, as co-chair, pushed there by President Trump. And we're seeing that he's able to line his own pockets by advocating and encouraging the Iran war, pushing this one big, beautiful bill. He owns pharma company stocks, and we know that those have gone up because of this one big, beautiful bill. He was also chair of the North Carolina Republican Party and recruited right-wing candidates like Mark Robinson, who's the self-described black Nazi in North Carolina and stood beside and behind Mark Robinson. He has lied about my record. You mentioned that he's been telling people that he grew up in Blowing Rock, North Carolina. In actuality, he moved to Blowing Rock from Michigan when he was 15 years old. And that I don't mind people coming into North Carolina. Well, you don't have to have grown up in North Carolina. People are full North Carolinians when they move here, but just don't lie about it. But he's lied about my record, and particularly on crime. But then you look at his record on crime. He appointed a convicted child sex predator who served time in prison to a prominent position in the North Carolina Republican Party and stood by him and reappointed him, even though the party debated this. And recently the party has come in and passed a resolution saying we aren't going to have sex predators appointed to positions of prominence anymore. He's also very recently stood by Trump's pardon of all of these J6 insurrectionists, including those who assaulted police officers and including those who went on to commit other crimes, some against children for child sex crimes. That's the kind of record that Michael Whiteley has. And as I say, he will do and say whatever this president tells him to do and say. On the other hand, I will be a strong independent senator for North Carolina. I will put the people first. I will try to work with this president when I can. I did my first 4 years as governor. He was president at the same time. I tried to work with him. We had to go through COVID and other things. But I will stand up to him when I need to. And there needs to be a lot of standing up to him right now in Washington. I think the people of North Carolina are going to want that at the end of the day.
You mentioned the attacks on your record on crime. This is in a bunch of their ads. This is seems to be their main strategy for trying to defeat you, is to paint you as weak on crime, weak on immigration. They are specifically focusing on some early releases that you granted in your time as governor. What is your response to those attacks? What's the true story here?
Well, first, those stories, there are many lies being told in what they've done, and they've had fact checks that have shown that they just simply are not telling the truth. I'm the only person in this race who's actually prosecuted violent criminals and worked to keep them behind bars, while Michael Whiteley has appointed a child sex predator to a prominent position in the North Carolina Republican Party. That's the difference between us on crime. People know my record as attorney general. They know that as governor, I signed tougher bail laws. They know, too, that I believe in working to prevent crime by investing in early childhood education and in our public schools and in health care and in our communities. I think that's critical. They believe this is a soft spot. It is not. And I think the people of North Carolina will hear that at the end of the day.
You know, immigration and crime are sort of tied together in Republican rhetoric these days. One of the tasks for a Democratic Senate will be, or just new Democratic senators, is going to be trying to find ways to rein in what is happening with ICE and what the Trump administration is doing with ICE. We just had another person killed by ICE recently. How are you thinking about if you were elected Senate, what you would do with ICE? Like how would you reform it, restrain it? What are you thinking?
Well, first, we need secure borders in this country, and we should deport violent criminals. And this organization should be working to try and do that. But we also don't need what is happening now with people being picked up just because of what they look like, often American citizens being put in danger, shot on the street. It seems to me reasonable that officers who work with ICE should have the same requirements that state, local, and federal law enforcement officers should have. And I think that is something that we need to do, make sure that they have those same requirements.
As we mentioned, your opponent's the former chair of the RNC. A couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court had a ruling which now will allow the party committees like the RNC and the DNC to spend unlimited funds on behalf on races like yours. How does that ruling affect your race with your opponent being the former chair of the organization that can now spend unlimited money?
This is the worst campaign finance Supreme Court decision since Citizens United. It allows virtually unlimited spending from these joint committees when a candidate and a political party or like the Republican senatorial campaign committee come together, they don't have any limits as they used to have. This puts more power in the hands of the very wealthy, of the billionaires, of the corporations. And I think you're going to see a significant amount of money flowing into races all across the country using this new device. It may affect our race even more than others, being that Whatley has been recently the chair of the Republican National Committee. He knows all the people there. He certainly has been talking about the fact that they're going to use this new tool. We all need to come together and get a grip on campaign finance in this country. We have to find a way to stop this madness. It's too much money in politics. I'll be first in line to find a way to overturn Citizens United. But until then, we cannot unilaterally disarm. This takes power away from small donors. And I hope small donors will stand up and say, we're not going to let this happen. We're going to give these candidates even more. RoyCooper.com is a great place to go and to do that, because we need to have a strong voice for everyday people. And this new decision just allows more money into the system. It leads to more corruption. We see open corruption in Washington right now. In fact, my opponent, as I mentioned, owns individual stock. When I ran for governor, I sold all of my individual stock. I have widely held mutual funds. I'm doing that during the campaign. I will do that as a United States senator, regardless of what the law is, but I will work to pass a law that prohibits members of Congress and high executive officials from trading individual stocks. I'll support a law that stops allowing people to be lobbyists after they serve in Congress. We need to get people to trust the federal government again. And right now, people just don't. So we have to elect people not only who will fight to change laws. We're seeing that we have a lot of people who want to change the laws, but nothing ever happens in Washington on this, but who will set examples. And that's what I want to do when I get there. And the way this money is going to come in, I hope it won't affect these elections, because I hope that people will step up and help these candidates. We've got to take back the House. We've got to take back the Senate. We've got to make sure that we come back to the Constitution that the framers intended, where we have true checks and balances, because right now we have leaders in Congress who simply will not stand up to the president. And you need to do that regardless of party. You need to do that. And the branches need to push against each other in order to make this great republic work.
I'll say this for you to make it easier, but the ruling means that the RNC has a lot more money than the DNC. The NRSC has more money than the DSCC. The Republicans have more money than the Democrats. If we are going to, the only way we're going to stay competitive in these races is for people to go to websites like RoyCooper.com and push back. Because it's not, we can win with grassroots donations. We are not going to match them billionaire for billionaire in this race. So just wanted to lay that out there. I would do that for you, make that pitch easier for you.
You said it better than yes. I. And I think you're right about that, because we can't catch up. The DNC just simply can't catch up before November. So we're going to have help from everyday people out there.
The Democratic Party is in a bit of transition these days, and we have Democratic Socialists winning in New York City and Colorado. We have progressive anti-establishment candidates winning here and there. We also have Roy Cooper's running in North Carolina and Sherrod Brown's running in Ohio. Is there a tent big enough for the party these days? Like, how are you thinking about what's going on in the party? You know, you're a two-term governor, you're an establishment figure. There's this anti-establishment sort of fervor going on. Like, how are you navigating all of this?
Well, I understand why people are frustrated, because government often hasn't worked at the federal level and people are mad. And so I get it. People are paying too much. Things are costing too much out there and they're frustrated. They don't have health care. They can't afford a place to live. My goodness, they had one bipartisan thing that they did, the housing bill that just got flipped on its head. That's just so frustrating. But look, I can just tell you what we've done here. I was a Democratic governor for 8 years. I had a Republican legislature for 8 years. And yes, I vetoed a lot of bad legislation and we fought over a lot of things. But I found ways to work with them on recruiting good paying jobs to our state, to getting paid parental leave, to passing a law to get our power sector to carbon zero by 2050. And finally, got a Republican legislature in a southern state to expand Medicaid, which has made a real difference. And we did that by getting their constituents in these red rural counties to lobby them for it. Because when I would use my contacts with sheriffs in some of these counties when I served as attorney general, and many of them would complain to me that essentially that a lot of people in their jail were struggling and needed health care. And so they understood that Medicaid expansion would bring more help to their county with medical services and would help keep their rural hospitals open. And when you have a tough on crime Republican sheriff walking the halls lobbying for Medicaid expansion, it's very effective. And so we were able to work together on a common goal to get health care. And these red rural counties have benefited really more than anybody else here. 730,000 people and counting now have health care in North Carolina. And there are ways to work together. We saw it on the housing bill in Washington. We've got to have more people who are willing to sit down at the table, even if they have disparate opinions. When you look at goals, often our goals are shared. Even if we are on opposite ends politically, we want a good education for our kids. We want a good paying job. We want clean air and water. We want quality health care. We all want the same things. And we have to be willing to sit down at the table and find ways forwards, find a way to achieve consensus. I did that as governor time and time again. I want to do that in Washington. And I believe that Washington could use a dose of North Carolina common sense. So I'm ready to come and try and provide that, not only from a governor, attorney general perspective, a state legislator perspective, but I practiced law for 18 years and was a managing partner of my small firm for a while. I had to make a payroll. So I have a lot of background that I think I can use in helping to shape legislation, walking across the aisle, trying to find a way forward, because people just want government to work. And right now it's not.
I think, Governor, it's a great place to end it. Governor Cooper, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
All right. That's our show for today. Thanks to
Roy Cooper. It was so fast. Sorry to cut you off.
It's been an hour. We've been doing this for an hour.
No, I mean,
we were having this much fun.
Emotional look, highs and lows. It was exceptional.
Yes, it was important because it was our last Grand Platinum conversation ever.
Oh my God. Mark that on your calendars, people.
I know, seriously. Okay. That's our show for today. Thanks to Roy Cooper for coming on. Tommy will be back in the feed on Sunday with a conversation with Gary Lineker, host of The Rest is Football and legendary England striker, to talk about the World Cup and the politics of soccer. Talk to everyone soon. Bye, everyone.
Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Austin Fisher, Saul Rubin, McKenna Roberts, and Farrah Safari, with Reed Cherlin, Elijah Cohn, and Adrian Hill. Our team includes Matt DeGroat, Ben Hethcote, Charlotte Landis, David Tolles, Mia Kelman, Ryan Young, and Naomi Sengel. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.